How's it going?
Hey, Pat. What's happening?
Not much.
What's this I hear about goats?
Yeah, two baby goats on their way next week. Nubian goats.
When I heard Pat Donahue and goats, I just assumed that you meant greatest of all time.
Nope. Not talking about Tom Brady here.
Okay,
goats.
Hopefully someday, if there's a podcast Hall of Fame, we can get your salt and pepper head hanging from the top. Not like a severed head, not like a bloody head, but but like just kind of a middle-aged guy with three kids and 12 goats.
Shaggy hair, yeah. Well, welcome. The U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations. We're going to defang the term socialism and explore how governments, with just a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
I sure hope so, Pat.
Yeah.
So, when you and I were talking this week, it came up that we've been somewhat singularly focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, which is understandable because it is kind of all-consuming. But as we take a step back, a couple of white dudes, you're pretty white, right, Pat?
That's true. Yep.
I've been white all my life. Recognizing that as bad as this is for everyone, I think that this pandemic has exposed some underlying truths about marginalized communities. And today, in particular, we're going to take a look at Black people and their plight over the course of many decades, but particularly as it relates to this COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, and so that it's not two white dudes talking about it, we have brought on two of our friends to tell us about what it's been like in their lives and in their communities as well.
That's right. And our producers have asked us to take a step away from the ridiculousness, which is our normal commercial schedule. And so we're going to try each week to promote a cause which could be a source of improvement in people's lives. Today, I know there's one close to your heart, Pat, and one that I'm going to be talking about. What's Fair Fight 2020?
Well, so we've been concerned about election security and making sure that there isn't any fraud in our elections, but specifically making sure that all voters have the chance to cast their vote. So Fair Fight 2020 has spearheaded that, and we're going to promote their efforts. And you're going to be looking at what group?
Rescuing Leftover Cuisine. The other day, I actually, as a school counselor in the Boston Public Schools, was seeking out a food resource for a family, and in short, Rescuing Leftover Cuisine seeks to allocate the 40% of the United States food supply, which is discarded every week, right? And, you know, every day, in fact, in the United States, and how we can, during a global pandemic, not necessarily find new food, but simply reallocate the food that we already have.
That's great. So stick around, folks.
We'll be right back.
This week's episode is brought to you by Fair Fight 2020. Now, Dan and I had a chance to sit in on a webinar put on by Stacey Abrams this week. And what I was struck by was just how much of a laser focus she has on making sure that everyone has the access to the vote that they need and that they deserve under our Constitution. Now, Stacey Abrams started this group just after the election in 2018 when Brian Kemp was the Attorney General and also running for governor. And they were able to exclude hundreds of thousands of people from the vote. And it most certainly cost her the governorship. But she didn't sulk about it. She got right to work starting this group. And they've already put into place protections in 18 states, making sure that they are watching to make sure that people who should be on the voter rolls are on the voter rolls. They are engaged in litigation, legislation, and advocacy to make sure that everyone has their constitutionally mandated right to vote. You can support Fair Fight 2020 by going to fairfight.com, FAIRFIGHT.com. Once you're on the site, you'll have a chance to sign up and donate. Please do, folks. Our election depends on it.
Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism. I think it's helpful to give our audience just a quick snippet of how you and I got to know each other. You want me to tell the story? Or you want to tell it?
You could tell it. You could tell it. Go ahead.
Okay. So,
sure.
So Terrence and I met probably pretty close to 10 years ago now, maybe 8 years ago, where his nephew Shelton was. Let's just say we had a family meeting. Sometimes kids need to have a family meeting. And we did that, and we were trying to get Shelton back on the right track. And over the course of many years, due to some mistakes he made, and also the systems, you know, within our society did not treat Shelton so well, and he passed away in 2017. And we, as a result of that, we came and we created a scholarship in his name. So that's how you and I know each other.
Yep.
And so I think I may have told you that this episode is focused on the Black community and marginalized communities more generally, and how resources, or the lack of resources, has really set folks back for a number of years. But this COVID-19 crisis is really bringing some stuff to light that maybe could be a possible sign for some hope as we move forward. So I was hoping, Terrence, you could just give our listeners a little background on what it was like for you, where you grew up, what it was like for you growing up, and then maybe like how your path diverged from some of the kids you grew up with, who might have had a less successful, time since then.
I like to equate my life to the old saying of good luck and hard work. You know, I grew up in Dorchester, originally Grove Hall, over on Maple Court, Crawford Street, Eggleston, down on School Street, Franklin Field, Dunlap Street, and Common Square. And the reason I have all those addresses is because I grew up dirt poor. I'm talking like two pair of pants in the third grade type of poor, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember coming home from school and go in my closet and say, well, what am I going to wear tomorrow? It would be the other pair of pants. So everything that comes with that, you know, like the food stamps, the big white can with the pig on it, which was the government's version of Spam. Also, government cheese, which is a beautiful staple of life. So, so I grew up really poor. And the funny thing is, I came up through the Boston Public Schools. But one of the things that happened is my freshman year of high school, I was supposed to go to Madison Park High School. And my mother, out of nowhere, was like, we're going to go move to Detroit. And her sister had houses out there.
What? So
moved out there. Yeah.
Thanks, so Mom.
So I go to Detroit, which was it's like rewinding like 5 years of what was happening in Boston, because things trend from the coast and go to the Midwest. So it was a little bit slower, but it was too slow for me. I couldn't wait to get back. I mean, when I got to Detroit, they were wearing Jerry curls and fur coats and stuff. And I was like, this is not Boston.
Like Motown. You know?
Yeah. So when I got back,
So keep in mind, I grew up in Grove Hall at that time, and we did things like throw the football. We played basketball. We had like a basketball hoop on our street on a pole. And we made go-karts, built clubhouses. But when I got back, crack had like really hit my area where I lived. And all of a sudden, these guys I grew up with, like seriously, a year later, became these hardcore, like, drug dealers, gang members. I mean,
wow.
A lot of my friends were just dropping like on a weekly basis. It was a weird scenario.
You mean dying, or becoming addicted?
No, they were killing each other for turf, right. For turf wars. It shocked me, man. It just shocked me. And so I always say the luck part is that I had moved away from Boston. That was trending towards that. That when it actually hit, and I'm assuming the recruitment happened for the different drug areas, Castlegate, Humboldt, which is now H Block, Heath Street Academy, the Timberwolves over in Eggleston. It was like they were popping up everywhere. I mean, you couldn't wear certain hats at that time. When they were recruiting for these gang members, which, you know, you grew up in that neighborhood, you just became a part of that gang. I wasn't there. I was in Detroit.
You missed that.
So that was the luck part for me. One more thing. I remember going to Chez Vu's every Saturday night. No, Friday night. That's the roller rink over here on Washington, on Blue Hill Ave. And they had this wall of like kids who were killed, and like every week you would go to this roller rink, and that the names would just be added on this wall. Man, it was eventually it just filled up the whole wall. It was ridiculous, man. So it was surreal, you know.
It's kind of like it makes me think of, obviously I didn't grow up around here and I didn't grow up in these communities, but I'm picturing those candle vigils that you see around the city.
Yeah,
you know, they just pop up out of nowhere, and it's in a way it's humbling because you're like, that's a soul right there, right?
Yeah.
But it's also weird for a kid to grow up thinking that that's normal to have these, to go to your roller skate rink and see your peers up on there, not for winning, you know, not for having straight A's, but for having died too young.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, what were the choices at the time? School was not a difficult thing for me. I could do the work. But for some kids who had the slightest of struggle, it was easier to check out. I mean, where I grew up at, my mother had did 5 years in the federal in Framingham Penitentiary. Mm-hmm. When she got out at 23, she became pregnant with me. And I was watching soap operas with her all day. My mother didn't know. She dropped out of school in eighth grade and went a different way. But my mother didn't know. If it wasn't for my favorite president, no, it's not Barack. He's number two. My favorite president was Lyndon Lyndon Baines Johnson, because he started Head Start for me. And because of Head Start, I got to watch Sesame Street. All of a sudden, I can go to Head Start for half a day. I went to Head Start on Geneva Ave. And
it's still there, the same one next to the Holland?
Yep. Yeah, and I think I still got the picture. My teachers were black with afros. I loved that. You know,
now was that back when you had hair?
Yeah. I had an afro too.
Oh, I gotta see those. You're gonna tag me in those.
I'm gonna hide those. So I mean, like I let's go back to the luck, you know, that I was born at this time and these programs came available, you know, on the left coast. That it was just like, wow. So that's where I learned to read Sesame Street and Head Start. And, you know, my mother's mentality was, hey, you have a roof over your head and some food to eat. You're good as far as parenting goes. She didn't know she was supposed to read to me every night or anything. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in that environment where you just did enough to get by in school. So school was easy to me, and I did that. What I really wanted growing up was Adidas, a pair of Adidas or a Kango or look fresh. It was no – in my neighborhood, I'm still in Grove Hall before all that. There were no fathers. There were no black men around. It's like, hey, look what I'm doing, you know. It was all welfare mothers in my neighborhood and kids.
Well, can you talk about – so that leads me to – my next question, which is, can you talk about, you mentioned the crack epidemic and the impact of coming into that, coming, having been outside the state and coming back and witnessing that. And then at the same time, you had the war on drugs from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the impact of the sort of like no excuses war on drugs on the Black community? Because I feel like we're still kind of in it. You know, it's a generation or almost two generations later, but the impact of not having father figures in so many of these homes, I feel like is still reverberating throughout a lot of cities in the United States.
Well, I'm gonna push back a little bit, but at the time, you know, the government's reactionary. They see all these killings, they see crack coming, just disseminate neighborhoods,
right.
Just change the roles. I remember, because I'll be honest, me, my two brothers, we sold drugs a little bit. I remember my younger brother, man, he was like 13 talking to this adult woman like she was like 12 or something to him. I remember thinking at that age, like, something's wrong here that you get to speak to this adult any way you want. So it hit the Black communities, and obviously if it's just hitting people of color, the answer is always punishment and mandatory minimums, and we're not going to deal with it like they do now with heroin. Like, oh, you know, it's a sickness, it's work, it's no therapy allowed, it's just you're going to jail for the rest of your life. So a lot of my friends, if they weren't killed, they were being locked up for like double digits of their lives, just gone, like, just
right,
like literally what they say, into the belly of the beast. We would just say, what's the name's in the belly of the beast? And it was like someone was just snatching Black bodies off the street.
Right.
One of those things, I don't know if you ever watched This Is America, the video by, why is his name? The Childish Gambino.
I have not.
You should,
but I will.
You should watch it. It's all kind of symbolism there. But anyways, at the end of that video, there's a scene where he's dancing on all of these old cars from like the 90s, and he's just dancing. And when I read into it, what it symbolizes is mandatory minimum. This whole generation of boys/men of color were arrested at phenomenal rates because of the drug on war, the quote drug on war. So that is it's very haunting for me when I see that.
Well, and so, you know, you're an administrator in a Boston public school.
Yes.
And I also work in the Boston public schools. And I wonder what, I see a lot of policies and procedures that come down that are meant to, quote unquote, preserve learning time or keep the word culture gets used a lot, which is weird because culture is like, you know, what defines a community.
Mm-hmm.
But in schools, culture can mean you got to get these kids to conform. You got to get them to fall in line.
Yep.
And I wonder what you think about the association between discipline practices in schools and what happens to kids as, you know, you go from a 12, 13, 14-year-old boy who's getting in a lot of disciplinary infractions, a lot of phone calls home, and then all of a sudden you're 18 and you're in jail. Like, what is the – is there a correlation between – how we raise young men of color and where they end up?
Well, obviously, you've heard the old adage about the third grade exam and everything, and how that dictates how many beds should be
prison beds
in the future. But
yeah.
But something happens between fifth grade and eighth grade, I believe, personally, where and it could be external for the kid's life or what's happening at home. You know, maybe education is not, it's like a rhetorical conversation where the kid comes home and the parents like, how was school today? Oh, it was good. And then that's it. It's not like, well, what did you do? What happened in math? Mm-hmm. They're not digging into that, or it's not a major part of the conversation in class. At home, at the dinner table, because they're dealing with parents who maybe have to work two or three jobs just to pay for that rent that overpriced rent, or it might be drug addiction or violence in the home, or it could be anything like a student who doesn't have the proper citizenship papers, things like that. So they're dealing with that, and then education becomes the back burner. It becomes the warehouse for the parent. Where my kid's in school, they're safe. I don't have to worry about that. Or my parent doesn't really understand school. I mean, you hear it now when parents, the kids are like, could you help me with my math? And you're like, that's not the math I was taught, you know? So imagine educated adults. So imagine parents who may have just finished high school. But anyway, so something happens between fifth grade and eighth grade where kids start to check out because it is becoming more punitive, where they have to sit in class and you know the routine. Are you tracking the speaker? Are you engaged in the classwork? Oh, you're acting like a teenager or a preteen or a tween. Get out. That's a punishment. Go ahead.
Yeah, can we call out our boy Shelton, so who we both knew and loved? So Shelton he would get involved in a lesson in a very participatory way. So he had a thought, you were going to hear it. It doesn't matter if someone else is talking. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really, you know, but it wasn't in a rude way, but he was going to tell you what he thought.
Oh yeah.
And a lot of educators could not or would not respond to that, wouldn't roll with it, right? So he ended up in the system, so to speak, of the school because he was loud. He put it out there. Mm-hmm. He was who he was, but he wasn't coming at it from a perspective of, let me sabotage this class. He was saying, like, I have a thought. Listen to me. You know, like, if we were having a conversation, the three of us right now, I don't think anybody would be getting a word in.
Oh, yeah.
He hadn't learned the social norm of, like, waiting, you know, waiting out and hearing different perspectives. Mm-hmm. But he was engaged. Absolutely.
Yeah, but so, listen, you have, like, three Sheltons in one classroom. All of a sudden, as an instructor, you have this pacing guide. You got to stay on point. Everybody's coming in your room. And you're being judged on if the kids are behaving. So it's like, for some teachers, like, you got to get out, man. You're messing it up for me here. And
your evaluation is on the line.
Yeah, yeah. So you're right. There's no room for allowing a student like that who has academic discourse, you know, for what's being taught. There's little room for that when the students allow this question certain things, you know.
Right.
Whereas in like a Montessori school or somewhere, that's they're pushing for that type of thing, you know.
But you need resources, and you need someone to plug you in to that and pay $20,000 a year.
Oh, right? For the Montessori. But if schools were allowed to do what works, do what works for them, for their specific kids, you'd have a different scenario. Right. But yeah, it is although we're trying to go to restorative justice practices, there is still this old paradigm of, if we give kids some agency, we're going to lose control of the school and the kids won't learn. And it goes on from there. But yeah.
Right. So, hey, so we're running short on time, but I do want to skip ahead from your experience and Shelton's experience and look at this COVID-19 pandemic. And I've been watching the news and reading the news, which I'm sure you have as well. Yes. And they're talking about, well, people of color are getting this virus at higher rates. And, you know, it seems like they're involved in many industries where they're exposed more often, or they don't have paid sick time. Just today I was on a school call, Terrence, and I work in a middle school. And they said, well, what happens if the economy opens up and all the parents who were previously home, right? Mm-hmm. They got to go back to work, and I got a 12 or 13 year old. Now they're the babysitter.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now they're the caretaker because mom or dad or grandma is at work. Mm-hmm. How do you see this COVID virus either exposing or perhaps, I hope not, but perhaps making worse some of the disparities that people of color, like, this isn't news to y'all, no. Right? This isn't something that you're like, I can't believe it. But for some reason, the popular media and society is maybe getting their eyes opened a little bit.
I mean, you would hope, but then there's this knee-jerk reaction of let's get things back to the way they were. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. This epidemic, this pandemic is a game changer. This is a paradigm shift right here. We're never going, as the governor of New York was saying, Cuomo, we're not going back to that. There'll be a new normal. I hope one is for my community. Let's say I work in the transport section of Brigham and Women's Hospital. I gotta go to work every day. I understand this is going on. I gotta pay my bills for my wife and kids. I gotta go to work. There's not even like a big discussion going on. That's just what it is. Hopefully the people who are allowed to stay home, including myself, who are in a different tax bracket, I have the ability to say, I mean, have the wherewithal to rethink other perspectives, because I find that people that go and vote, and I'm well aware that I'm in a bubble here in the East Coast, in Boston.
Yeah.
But people that go to vote, they usually vote for their own best interests, you know?
That's right.
But I'm hoping this thing right here will align perspective, because to watch the news and see these people in their scrubs, or to see these people who still get on the bus. I think there was like 50 people in New York, 50 Metro drivers in New York have died from this already. Like, that's the train driver and the bus driver. And that's New York City. Like, stuff like that, I hope it hits home and makes them look twice at that person that may be delivering your food for Uber Eats, or Uber come pick you up, or you hop on the train, or anything. There are people who still out there working and chancing it all, because they have bills to pay. And hopefully that'll bring about some change as far as the bad word, you know, the socialist programs that are available in America, which nobody wants to call them.
You got to be careful.
Hopefully we'll make the definition less abrasive and archaic, as people still, once you drop that word in some people's conversation, it's you're just left-leaning, pinko, wacko, libtard, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because you're bringing this thing full circle. Our show is not about promoting socialism. In fact, we're just trying to shine the light on the fact that there already is. America is a socialist society. It just happens to be for corporations and rich folks, who know they know how to turn the wheels of power. So I guess as we leave this time of, you know, social distancing and we get back to work, you know, do gig workers have health care and paid time off? You know, do bus drivers, if they're sick, you know, can they go and get medical treatment? Because my guess is a lot of folk could have lived, would they have known confidently, I can take a week off, right? And my family won't stop eating. Yep. But I feel like a lot of these service industry blue collar jobs, they're just trying to survive. So they're not gonna push the envelope. They're gonna keep showing up to work. And and as someone, you know, you and I both, because we're in a union, or we have these protections, we have a privilege of staying home.
Yes.
And these folks are literally going in some cases, to their death, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but we are over our time, as I expected we would be. But I want to just appreciate you. I know you're still doing a full time job. You got a couple kids running around there.
That is the job.
That is the job. But we appreciate you, Terrence, and keep up the good work, sir. Thanks for joining us today on Trickle Down Socialism.
Thank you, Dan and team. Hope to be reinvited. Is that a word? I don't know. But invited again to this forum of discussion.
I got your number. And, you know, as someone who does hiring in Boston Public Schools, you know I'm not going to forget you.
Okay. That's how it works.
It's hard out here. Every day is a hustle. You know that.
I know that.
All right.
All right, Terrence. See ya. Thank you.
Be well, man. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This week, Trickle Down Socialism takes a look at rescuing leftover cuisine. Did you know that 40% of food in the United States is thrown away? And that 1 out of 7 Americans are food insecure? Probably all of us during this pandemic have recognized empty shelves or food delivery services that are delayed. And the idea of empty shelves and empty refrigerators is something that's not new, sadly, to many Americans. So rescuing leftover cuisine, with the help of their supporters, has rescued over 4.4 million pounds of food since they were started in 2013 and served nearly 4 million meals. If you're looking for a way to support your local and national community during this time of pandemic, please consider a donation to Rescuing Leftover Cuisine. You can do that easily at rescuingleftovercuisine.org. And we thank you for your continued listenership to Trickle Down Socialism.
Deirdre, how's it going?
Hey.
Well, welcome to the podcast. I can't believe it's been 2 years since we were working at the same school. What have you been up to?
Working, mothering, and painting.
You've been painting? Oh, not like painting your walls, painting pictures?
Yes. Because I'm an artist.
Yes, that's true. Nice. Have you been posting that, or is the work you've been posting your students' work?
Oh, the work I've been posting is a combination of work found off of the Wikipedia.
Yep.
And the internet and students' work, some of it, but mostly it's not my work. I don't usually post my work because I have imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. Dan and I felt we were kind of ignoring a bunch of really important issues with this podcast. Mm-hmm. But because of the fact that we're both melanin deficient, we decided to bring in friends who could, you know, better speak to the experience of being a person of color in the U.S. during mm-hmm. this reign of terror from the current occupant of the White House. I used to love the conversations we had in the teacher's room at our old school.
Yep.
And so I've been kind of missing your perspective on things.
Yeah.
And
also they changed the way the teachers interact now at the school. So like, we don't have that way of fostering connections the way we did before, even though they would demand that we were quiet and we were like the most raucous group. But
so you have your own classrooms now. Is that how it goes?
Yes. Kind of takes away from the camaraderie, but
yeah, I feel that at my current school too sometimes. Yeah. But what's concerned you most about how this pandemic seems to be affecting communities of color?
What's confused? Well, you know, I'll always be very honest with you. Just medical care in general for Black people has always been very concerning to me. You know, I don't know where this adage comes from that we are able to like withstand pain and like withstand discomfort better than other races, but we are definitely discounted in those areas. I've had so many interactions where like I knew exactly what was going on, and I've had a doctor say, no, that's not what's going on with you, and they're like, well, no, like that's what's going on with me, I know what's wrong with me, and they're like, no, you know, we're gonna test you for something else, and it's like, don't do that. So
wow.
And that's a very general statement, but like, you know, one time I went to a hospital for an emergency situation. It was something that was very, it was life or death at the time, and I had a male doctor who was not of color tell me that he thought it was my appendix, and I was like, sir, it is not my appendix, it is something else more serious. I need you to give me an ultrasound right now, and I need my doctor here. And not only did he fail to call my doctor, my actual doctor, he sent me another doctor who asked me the same 1,000 questions he had already asked me.
Wow.
And then still downplayed me, but while giving me morphine at the same time. It was awful. So what I will say is, you know, that's just my personal experience. But there are many accounts where they're saying that Black people, saw something the other day that this woman was saying that Black people are not having the symptoms exactly the way that they are saying that the symptoms for COVID are happening, and that we might have more shortness of breath and more like bowel problems than like other races. And so we're not going in to the hospital because we think, you know, our shortness of breath is because we don't have our asthma pump, or
right,
we don't, we're walking up the stairs, or and we're having bowel problems because, you know, technically most Black communities are food deserts where there's not good food to have, or there's not produce, or there's not, you know, it's like we have a, unfortunately we have this history of eating, you know, trash.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that personal account you brought in. You know, we see the numbers out of cities like Detroit. There was a city councilor from Detroit on NPR the other day who said that he had 15 people in his life who had already died of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Did these numbers surprise you?
The numbers don't surprise me. The numbers don't surprise me. For me, I like to focus on like what is happening with the people who are recovering. But the people who are dying, like, what is it that is happening for them to, are they dying at a more accelerated rate because they're getting less care? Are they dying because they didn't go into the hospital soon enough, or did they, or were they turned away and then told to come back, you know, when their symptoms got worse, or they were, they refused testing? And I feel like a lot of times what's happening is that there's a lot of refusal of testing, especially in these places. Like, you know, like I haven't really heard Massachusetts really having a problem, but I did have a friend who did have, who did, was diagnosed with COVID, and she, because she worked at a hospital, had to call in and had to advocate for her own treatment to get tested. When she was tested, they had to put her in the hospital for 11 days. So my thing is, she's actually Asian. So is it for community of color? Are they dying more rapidly? Those are my big questions, you know, to, you know, in general.
Yeah.
And then are they being turned away and then treated, and then like being treated at the end, you know, when it's too late?
It's too late. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are my big questions for like what's happening like medically. I feel like there's a lot of blanket information, but they're not really documenting what's happening to communities of color because that's a common thing. Like, we're not going to document it because we don't want to look like the bad guy.
Right. Right. And so you kind of brought this up earlier when you mentioned the asthma pump, but another big factor that I'm reading that's leading to these higher death rates is the comorbidities, like, you know, chronic health conditions like diabetes and asthma, which are higher in Black communities than they are in white communities. Now, this feels to me, when I read about it, when I see it in our own students, to be, you know, something that is just unaddressed. Do you have any idea why the U.S. health system as a whole, or, you know, public health officials in cities haven't really dealt with those underlying issues of asthma and other chronic health issues?
I mean, you have to think, right? We live in a capitalistic state. So like what's the driving factor between asthma? Bad conditions, bad air quality conditions.
Yeah, environmental conditions, right? Sure.
So environmental conditions really contribute a factor, but think about it. All these, I mean, I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but a lot of these places are in the pockets of politicians.
Sure.
And if a lot of them are in poorer places, especially out like, you know, Midwest, you think about Midwest, there's a lot of factories. I myself grew up in a neighborhood, and the closest steel mill, because I'm from Western Pennsylvania, was maybe, what, 3-5 miles down the street?
Yep.
So when you think about those factors, you think about like poverty, and you think about like those things, like if the air quality is trash, right, you're going to have more students, more kids with asthma.
Yeah.
More kids were affected. If you have, and if you're in poverty, which is a very high number, unfortunately, for African Americans, you know, because there's a direct correlation between education, poverty, you know, and even like food, like eating.
Access to healthy food. Right. Yeah, sure.
So because of that, you know, we have to think like, what are the contributing factors for asthma? Poor air quality, poor health, right? And, you know, an exasperation of all these things is happening in the Black community. So I believe that because politicians are not going to deal with, they're not going to deal with big things like, you know, they're not going to get rid of mills for, you know, like, what are they talking about? They're just talking about now, like the processing plants are like suffering.
Sure.
They're in the pockets
meat
of a lot.
Processing
of, yeah,
plants. Yeah.
Those
yeah.
places are in the pockets of a lot of politicians. You think they're going to deal with that? That's a way of like that makes them lose money.
Right.
Or lose endorsements, or lose the things that they want. And so I think like, or lose the lobbying capabilities. I think for me, I think my biggest thing is recognizing is having like Black people always talking about like in their communities, really, really, really standing up for themselves and really, really like trying to make changes. So that's why you see like a lot of like Black urban farmers now.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
Popping up so big. So I think like the reason why politicians aren't dealing with it is because like it's all monetary.
Sure.
Follow the money is always what they say, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if the money leads to
something that's harmful to Black communities, then it's going to be harder for them to stop that.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Does this feel like this COVID-19 epidemic, the pandemic, and the way it's affecting communities of color? Does it? I know that you're also like you're an art teacher, but you're also a student of history. We've had plenty of conversations around that. Does this feel reminiscent of any other, you know, issues or diseases or problems that have hit the Black community disproportionately?
The drug epidemic, the idea that like these communities of color were being funneled with drugs, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I hate to say it, we're being funneled with drugs. You know, crack cocaine is a big deal. You know, we got the early 90s was like DARE, you know, like don't do drugs or
just say no.
Yeah, just say no. And, you know, but it's being funneled into our communities, right? So you have these poor communities, you know, crack cocaine is a big deal. You know, if you've ever watched the show Snowfall, like you see like how it happens, like it just infiltrated the Black community really big, right? Mm-hmm. Those people were treated like what, criminals?
Criminals. They were locked up at a much higher rate than white people who were using powder cocaine.
Right.
Yep.
And because they are being treated as criminals, right? So what happens? You're not getting treatment. You're not getting rehabilitation. You don't.
Right.
And because you're poor, you don't have access to going away to a 30-day retreat. You know, sure. That mommy and daddy paid for.
Yeah.
So because of those things happening, you're now in jail. You're locked up for 10 years for possession or whatever it is, or 15 years for possession.
Yep.
And then if you have bad behavior, you don't get out, you add years to it. And so like, it's just like this repeating epidemic, and it's a repeating epidemic that is not addressed, that is not taken care of. And then they're wondering why, like, well, why can't the Black community stand, like do what it needs to do? Well, because you've taken away a lot of the anchors of communities and family.
Sure.
Like the male, like the nuclear family is very hard to, I mean, we're getting back to it, but the nuclear family in the 80s and 90s for Black people, come on.
Yeah. Well, so how does that make you feel now when you see the heroin and opioid epidemic and it's hitting white people now, and there's all this talk of, oh, it's a disease and we need to treat it as such? How does that feel?
Damn, white people are baby. Like, really? We just go baby these white folks, like just babying them. Like I don't mean that for all, and I want to be very clear, but I mean for a lot of them, there is like this babying, there's just like this infantile like way of thinking about white folks. It's like they can't handle shit. And it's like, yo, y'all the biggest conquerors in the fucking known world. And y'all literally telling me you can't handle shit? Like you can't handle anything. You know what I mean? Like everything has to be, there's the amount of sensitivity in the white community is astounding. You know, it's like, I don't know. I just feel like, so I think like for as far as like the opioid and the heroin epidemic right now, they're like, well, you know, we got to get people, you know, it's a disease. We got to really try to take care of these people. I was like, you are not taking care of people. People are still incarcerated for things they did 20 years ago that are not even relevant. You have people who are being, you have Black people who are being arrested at very high, with like 40% higher than white folks about marijuana possession.
Right.
Those people are still in jail for marijuana possession from 10 years ago. And now you have white people who own stores where they're allowed to sell weed.
Right.
What the fuck? So as far as I'm concerned, my biggest problem is, when does the babying stop?
Right. So I've got one last question before we wrap, and I really appreciate your perspective on this. How do you feel about where we're headed? So I say that knowing that, you know, our best option in this upcoming election, as much as we might not be super excited about it, is Joe Biden as a presidential candidate. We do have some great representatives. We have Ayanna Pressley here in Massachusetts. But do you feel like we're on a better track? Do you, like, just tell me your outlook heading into the election in 2020?
All right, election 2020. I feel like, you know, the world can go, always somebody's going to say the world can go either way. Unfortunately, I cannot say with confidence that I believe that Joe Biden would win. I'm not 100%. And I know that that sounds like, you know, like kind of like a doomsday kind of thing. But what I will say is this. You have a lot of representatives. You have Auntie Maxine out in Cali. You have mm-hmm. Anna here. You have all these people. There's a lot of people who are coming out of the woodworks who are really trying to push for Black people to be very involved in the vote. Not even just in the vote, but just in their communities and learn what the beginning is. If you ever get a chance to, you can listen to our good friend Angela Rye. She has a podcast called On One with Angela Rye. She's a political commentator for CNN, and she does a lot of community work, but she's also a lawyer, and she's amazing. Like, she's far more intelligent than I will ever be when it comes to talking about this kind of stuff. But I will say this, that she makes it clear every time. She was like, it's more than the president. It always starts at the community level. Always starts at that level. So if you recognize it starts at the community level, then those people are the people who move up if you keep voting them in. Those are the people that, you know, go farther if you keep voting them in, if you keep believing in them, if you keep holding them accountable. Because you can hold someone like your councilwoman more accountable in person than you can your president, right?
Sure, absolutely.
So that being said, recognizing that it's not just the vote about the president, it's always going to be about midterms. It's always going to be about voting in, you know, your local person, whoever it is, even if you're in a union, who is your union person working out for you, whatever it is, be involved. Sure. That's one. Two, my other thing is that, you know, as far as Black people are concerned, I think like we need to, you know, we need to go back to a lot of basics that I hope that we are going back to now, which is thinking like having more confidence to grow your own food, having more confidence to, you know, you can eliminate the food desert if you have the produce at your house, right? So the way to get that is to grow it. Grow it yourself. You may not have space. I have an apartment. I have like a semi garden in a corner of my kitchen right now.
Nice.
And a lot of that has to do with the fact that what is it that I'm lacking? I can go to the store. I'm privileged. I 100% believe I'm privileged. I have a great job. I get paid well. I have a car. I can go to the grocery store. But for those of you who don't, get some dirt, figure it out. Big deal. That's one. And then the other thing is, I think that Black people lack a sense of community in a lot of ways. And I think the reason why we lack a community is because we've been separated for so long. I think that we've been separated for so long because like we have given into the idea that white is right. We need to stop doing that. We need to recognize our own power. But a lot of this is happening for our community. And I think we just need to be more poignant, more like we need to fight a lot harder for those things to happen. I think COVID-19 is kind of like, it's almost been kind of like a great equalizer in a lot of things when it comes to like talking about like what is happening with our bodies within the Black community. Are we taking care of ourselves with what we're eating? And a lot of us are not. So, you know, immunity comes from the food we eat. Immunity comes from, you know, those things. I'm not saying those are fix-alls. I'm saying that as a helper. It's an assistant.
Sure, absolutely.
So I think that the more that we explore just knowing what we should be eating and things like that and taking care of ourselves internally. Diabetes can be cured if you eat right, if you take care of yourself, if you work out, you can get rid of, you can lower your symptoms. I know for facts. So I think that we need to think about those things, become more educated. And I mean, even if it starts by reading an article on the internet is still, you know, reading. I don't care if it's not a book.
No, that's right. That's right. It is.
So as far as I'm concerned, I think those are the biggest things for the Black community to do, to recognize, you know, like I said, there are probably people far more intelligent or far more eloquent than I am talking about these things. But I think that those are the most important things.
Great. I really appreciate you taking the time to work with us on this podcast. And folks, heard it here first. White is not right.
Yo, let me tell you though, I'm not gonna lie though. You and Dan though, you're making white right for a lot of cases. You know what I mean? I will say this. I'm very privileged to know this. One thing I will say is that I always came into like when I came into education, I was like, man, we're just gonna do everything like the white folks want us to do. Damn. And I've met a lot of, and I will say this, I've met a lot of, and I will be very specific. I've met a lot of white males. I'm not talking about females. I think they're extremely problematic, and I hate to say that out loud, but I think a lot of white.
No, it's okay. I'm not going to even touch that. Let's just go with that point.
But I think a lot of white males that I have met in education, if they are willing to listen a lot more. and extract information and try to apply it for dealing with Black and Brown students. And I've had that experience because I've dealt with you and Dan, even our good friend Chap. I think that I've dealt with a lot of them, and I've had there's a higher percentage of white males who have been like, you know what, this kind of shit's not right. What can I do? And ask the questions than their counterparts. I apologize for saying that, but that is just my personal opinion.
Okay, well, that might be unpopular, but it is your opinion, and that's what we share here on the podcast. So thank you so much, Deirdre, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, and I miss talking to you every day.
Yeah, take care.
All right, bye-bye.